Welcome to C2Y Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care. My name is Wolfgang Vachon. I've made the comment, only half-jokingly, that the hardest part of working with children and youth is working within organizations and with other adults. That the young people are the easiest part of the work. It is the colleagues, managers, directors, and structures that make the work so difficult. Many of us have had the experience of working with people and wondering, why are they working with children and youth? We have walked out of supervision and thought, why does strength-based not extend to staff? Perhaps certain staff always seem to have incidents on their shifts, while we look forward to working with other staff because things just seem to go smoothly when we're with them. Or perhaps there are organizations where there appears to be a great deal of challenges, while other organizations with the same population of young people, maybe even the exact same young people, do not seem to have the same level of incidence. Von Bowie has been exploring these difficult questions for close to two decades. He wrote one of the first books on workplace violence in child and youth care called Coping with Violence, A Guide for Human Services. I've asked Von to speak with us today about this challenging topic. Hello, Mr. Von Bowie, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Wolfgang. It's great to be with you.
Wonderful. Before we move into the topic of workplace violence, you are from Australia, and we have listeners from all over the world. I'd like to start, if you could perhaps give us a little overview of what child and youth care is like in Australia. Are there any unique aspects to it?
Yeah, there certainly are, and the key one is that we don't deal with children. We deal 10 or 12 up until 21, 25, so that whole area of children and their development is not something that that we actually have a remit to work with. Secondly, historically, we didn't come out of the children's homes or the children's hospitals, so we don't have a strong emphasis on the therapeutic counselling side of things. We train our youth workers to be, and this is a contradiction, but specialist generalists, that they can work across one-to-one work, interpersonal group work, and we have a strong emphasis on social action, community development and community change, because even if you're very good at the counselling therapeutic side, that the culture of the organisation or context or the society itself is creating these problems, we need to work not just at the individual or family level, but we need to help bring about social change. Which can sound rather challenging, and it is, and I had some Canadian students come out and study with me, and particularly one incident where a student said to me, why are we picketing a nuclear reactor? What's this got to do with child and youth care? And I explained to them that if the nuclear reactor goes off, there's no work left for any of us. And over time, they came to understand the importance of a total view on what they're doing, a societal top-down and bottom-up approach.
I'm intrigued because in North America, we have a very therapeutic approach, and in Canada in particular, our work is explicitly therapeutic. Why is it not so in Australia? Is it because of its origins not being in residential care?
I think that's part of it. We, as I said, historically, we didn't have the large institutions as you may have in parts of North America. So there just wasn't the work. For instance, our hospitals and our schools, many of them wouldn't employ or don't employ youth workers. So there's not that focus as well. But it's more very small agencies, and the total staff might be two people. You've got to do everything from being the janitor through to the fix-it man through to the counsellor through to the sometimes the cook and bottle washer and everything in between. So we don't have various specific areas of responsibility. Now, there are some larger agencies, some of whom you may be familiar, like St. Vincent de Paul and some of these others, which may have here larger environments. But Sydney has a population of 6 million people, and for that number we may have 30, 40 beds specifically in residential therapeutic care. So that gives you some example. I'm not sure what the examples, comparisons might be here, but I'm sure you've got a lot more residential beds, whereas we have probably per head of population many, many more shelter places or youth refuges, as we call them, where a lot of this work goes on. And there's a good side and a bad side of that. If we don't have the residential institutions and the psychiatric facilities, young people get labelled less often. But when something goes really wrong, we have difficulty finding places for them to go.
Are people in the shelters then doing the frontline work? Are they then doing counseling work? Are youth workers, you know, as they're cleaning up the space, also doing therapy with clients, or is it explicitly not seen as their role?
Because a lot of the agencies are community-based, they may have referral to other community-based counselling, etc., but no, you know, they do what youth workers do. They provide informal mentoring, guiding, counselling, if you want to call it that, but it's maybe kitchen sink counselling rather than sit down behind the desk sort of counselling. So they do much the same sort of stuff as you guys do, but maybe not so much in the therapeutic sort of context. As I said, that's both good and bad. And as you know, you get a bunch of mental health professionals together, you know, if they get paid for labelling people, that can become a perpetuating cycle where the mental health system and other systems actually, whether they want to or not, gives these people labels. And sometimes the kids live up to these labels.
When you and I have been in conversation before, you've asked the question, do young people need another therapist? And embedded in that question was the role of youth worker, as you call them in Australia, is something other than that. Could you expand a bit upon that idea?
Well, I think North America is in danger of losing the original concept of what youth workers were about, which were a friend, a guide, a mentor, a companion. But now there's a danger that they're becoming more clinicians or a therapist. You know, they're trying to get accreditation with, you know, psychotherapy associations and all this sort of stuff. We would say, if that's what you want, become a social worker or a psychologist or whatever. Whereas the unique role, as we said, of a youth worker is generally that informal relationship building and guiding, and also learning from the young person themselves. And this also partially comes from some of our British heritage, which also doesn't necessarily come out of the sort of therapeutic sick kids hospital sort of worldview.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The UK model, you know, particularly the youth worker UK model, is explicitly voluntary. It's explicitly anti-oppressive, and that seems to also ring true with what you're saying.
Yeah, they might not as consciously be working within an oppressive model, but they certainly are seeing that there's a need for societal as well as group and personal change.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier about not working with children, and that it's not part of how youth work is structured. Could you elaborate more upon that, and then who's working with the children?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good question. The short answer is not a lot of people. We have school counsellors who are trained psychologists, are former teachers. We have after-school programs, which may be run by youth workers. But generally, there are a different group of childcare, as we would call professionals, but they're coming more from the educational teaching background. So generally, though, with some exceptions, they're preschool teachers or trained elementary or high school teachers who may be doing some of that informally, or guidance counsellors, but we don't tend to have people from the child and youth care side of things working in that context. It may be a school social worker, or it may be a psychologist, or whatever. And I mean, just personally, I don't believe we need to be working with that younger age at this stage. I think it's such a wide range to some extent that the skills that may be needed with a two-year-old may have something in common with a 12-year-old, but they're also vastly different.
So you would see having unique fields or unique training for, you know, under 10s and over 10s, for example?
Yes.
Okay. It's quite illuminating and quite surprising when, as one learns more and more about different parts of the world and how youth work is structured.
Well, that's why we need to have that interaction and ask the difficult questions, as I like to do.
Yes, you do. You do like to ask those difficult questions. I want to turn now to your research on workplace violence. You've written a lot about it and burnout. You differentiate abuse of staff and abuse by staff. Perhaps we could start there.
I'll give you a preliminary, though, on that. How I actually got into that was my working with youth gangs, disenfranchised homeless kids on the street, and having to learn to stay alive and well while interacting with these guys. So it was from there that I began to have more than just a personal selfish interest. I mean, I'm allergic to violence. I break out in cuts and bruises, so I've learned a lot to try and avoid that. And that's when I realised there wasn't much else being written on that particular topic, that and people asked me to do some training for them, that I tried to, from my own wisdom, hopefully at that young age, to try and pass some handy hints along, just to maybe even avoid what I'd been going through. Yeah.
Because you are experiencing violence in your workplace with these young people.
Yeah. I mean, street work, as we call it, is a unique role to play, because you're on their turf, that you're there with their acceptance or otherwise, and it's not them coming to you, but you're going to them.
How were you experiencing workplace violence when you were working with this population?
At one level, and I'm showing my age here, but when I started doing that, this was the 60s, peace, free love, Vietnam, all those sorts of things, and we just started out opening our house up as what we called a crash pad, and we'd have kids come along occasionally with the head or their face rearranged by somebody else, or brawling with each other, et cetera. So, we had some coming into where we were both working, and which was also where I was living, which is a big mistake, as I learned later on. But nevertheless, then out on the streets, some people liked you, some people didn't. So you had to work the group dynamics. So those who liked you outnumbered those who wanted to rearrange you one way or the other. And so you just learned to be quick thinking, to be able to communicate, to be less liable to trigger violence. One of the stories, when I was running a coffee shop, group of guys came in and they began to make trouble and mess the place around, and often people would focus on the troublemakers actually doing the trying to trash the place, but I just sat down with a ringleader who was just observing what was going on, and just explained to him that we were glad to have the guys there, but if they messed it up, the place that was there might close us down, and you know, there wasn't a place, and it may not be a place for them to come. And could he help me out on this? So at the end of the night, we just sat talking, and he got all the other guys, gave them buckets and mops and brooms, and got them to clean up the place as we were talking. So if I just tried to settle down his underlings, you know, they would have just got worse and he would have egged them on. But I had to start with that guy and form a relationship with him and then get him to work with me for our mutual benefit. So that was one of the skills I learned. Yeah.
Okay. Perhaps we could move at this point in time to the discussion around abuse of staff and abuse by staff. What do you mean by these two terms?
Well, perhaps I should put it in a broader context. I have a model which has three basic levels of aggression and violence. And for sake of illustration, imagine a triangle. At the top, top of the triangle is the organization, its culture, management style. In the middle there is some workers and colleagues, and at the lower, the bottom in a sense, both in reality and in the illustration, we have the service users, the young people. And so I see workplace aggression, violence, abuse within that context. And my thesis, which we'll explore a bit later, is that often what's occurring, even say bullying of staff on staff, or incidents in residential care where young people may be bullying or aggressive or violent to each other, is not entirely but partially as a result of the organisational context, which may be cutting back on resources or may not providing a supportive and encouraging but a more punitive, restraining type environment. So that's the sort of model or framework which I operate on. And then recently in Australia, there's a investigation in one state into institutional abuse by staff of residents with disabilities. And it's easy in that situation to sort of point the finger at the staff who may be abusing or seem to abusing those in their care. And in fact, I'm not saying that that doesn't happen, and there are some predatory workers, a very small number, for whatever reason, that get involved in that sort of behaviour. But there's also a much larger group of workers who, because of the lack of resources, time pressures, etc., become the people that they don't want to be, but are forced into that because they're babysitting rather than providing a supportive, encouraging environment. So if they're getting more and more clients, young people, users to look after, they, as I said, they just become babysitters and may become abusive in that indirect way, or through just sheer neglect, not being able to provide the care that they need. So that's abuse by staff.
And that abuse by staff happens, you know, the more and more clients is because the organization has made a decision that they want more bodies for funding reasons, for example, or, you know, because there's larger systemic pressure saying we need to have more places for these young people to sleep, or situations like that.
Yeah, and they're also the organisation is under financial pressures to cut back or to, you know, save for money or on staff or whatever, and so that trickles down. But in fact, sometimes that's very short-sighted, because if you cut back on staff, you'll have more instances, your insurance premiums, workers' comp claims will go up, there'll be more police and juvenile justice involvement, there'll be possibly public scandals, etc., etc. So sometimes you've got to spend money in order to save money, strange as it may seem.
Right, so you're saying much of this abuse of staff, except for the outliers, may be caused by this organizational violence.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm not absolving anybody from direct responsibility for their behaviours, but sometimes that may, in case, be the fact why they are at least partially responding that way. And part of it too is that the least skilled staff, often of non-Caucasian background with limited English, may be involved in especially in large institutions, may be involved in the most direct care, but they have the least skills.
Because they don't have the formal education piece?
Yeah, and the research tells us too that both youth workers and more of the direct care workers often come from traumatized backgrounds themselves. So dealing with young people from traumatized background may re-traumatize or re-trigger in the staff some of their own background experiences which they thought they may have worked through or whatever. So it becomes a who's triggering who sometimes in these sorts of situations.
So that's abuse by staff. What do you mean by abuse of staff?
Well, as I was starting on there, it's more the traditional, in a sense, if that's the right word, but what is seen to be more widely acknowledged is that the service users may react negatively against the staff, and so that may lead to you know, workplace violence, sometimes occasionally bullying, but it may be physical assault or more often verbal assault or put downs or whatever. And in some instances, from my experience, the actual threat of violence is sometimes more worrying and emotionally damaging than the actual physical explosion when it's all over and gone. And in some, again, some staff who have been constantly harassed or harangued may in fact try to bring on a physical or emotional encounter just to clear the air, because they're just tired day in, day out of being a target of what they see as verbal and maybe physical abuse or racial slurs or that sort of stuff. So in a sense, that's what people think of when they talk about workplace violence in the youth and childcare field, whereas I see it as a much more multi-level situation, and it can also affect other colleagues as well. It's not necessarily the youth worker, the child and youth care worker who is attacked that's traumatised. It may equally be the staff who weren't able to intervene or didn't intervene for a variety of reasons, or did intervene and were also harmed themselves. So it's quite a complex, traumatic, stressful situation.
In the introduction, I talked about that perception of certain staff. There seems to be more incidents. Are you claiming that those or organizations where there's more problems, more incidents, that somehow it's the organization that is somehow responsible for the abuse of staff by residents, by clients, by young people?
Well, I certainly think that that's a contributing factor, and a very obvious one is, as I said, if an organisation cuts half its frontline workers, its child and youth care workers, and doubles for clients, there's going to be ramifications and implications for the young people. Now, as the staff then in those situations often become more punitive or custodial, the relationship breaks down between the young people. They feel frustrated. Maybe they have more casual staff. There's less relationships developed. And all of this, plus what the workers bring to the situation themselves, provides a very toxic environment, which generally, you know, will explode into more incidents of verbal or physical What that can happen sometimes is the organisation will blame the staff or the recalcitrant young people for those particular incidents, and so what they may do is implement a zero tolerance policy for violence, which from my research and writing is very ineffective and quite counterproductive. Or the other standard response is to further skill or upskill the staff in workplace violence and aggression training, which may be appropriate, but again is saying the problem lies with you, the worker, your lack of skills or your personal qualities, or because of the particular characteristics of the client server use basis. So rather than saying, well, hey, our organisation has provided the culture in which violence can grow, they can flick it back to the workers and to the service users and say, it's your fault that this is occurring. You do something about it, or get rid of or remove those young people who are creating the problems.
And when you introduce these notions to organizations, how do they respond?
Often it's not our problem, or this doesn't occur, or you're just describing, you know, firm management and appropriate leadership skills, etc., etc. So, and I mean, it's the most difficult place to start, but it's a place we have to start. And I think I use the expression sometimes, it's like placing Dracula in charge of the blood bank. they just don't realise that the way they manage the organisation can contribute to this trickle-down toxicity. Now, I'm not trying to paint people in black hats or white hats, the good guys and the bad guys, but as organisations are increasingly driven by the financial bottom line, they are helping to create these organisations. And talk to child and youth care workers who have been around for a while and can note these changes over time. They will tell you that the job is becoming harder, it's less rewarding, less positive, and over time the tone, the milieu of the organisation is changing from supportive to more mechanical and eventually toxic.
So what can be done to alter these organisational changes?
Mm-hmm. Well, primarily and foremost, what I'm doing is beginning conversations, asking the hard questions, throwing in hand grenades in meetings, in conferences and various places, because often the workers, again, are in a difficult position, or sometimes like the frog in the slowly boiling water, they don't realise what's going on. They just feel that they're more and more stressed and less appreciated, and sometimes for workers it's a great relief to say, hey, you know, it's not just me, it's the organisation as well. There are more enlightened organisations who are beginning to realise the interrelationship of what happens at the top with those all the way down. And I sometimes call it the when the CEO sneezes, the whole organisation catches a cold. And sometimes, again, the organisation makes changes, or if changes are forced on them, that they don't realise the ramifications. So talking about it, starting conversations, getting small groups of people to talk about it, training in team managers and middle-level managers, because when you talk to them, they will also admit often, if not in public and in private, that they themselves are the meat in the sandwich, and if they don't make these changes, their organisation may go under or their bosses may fire them, and so at times it takes great emotional strain on them. And so it's important to get the young people, the service users, the workers and the administration and managers to begin to explore these issues. And sometimes with smaller organisations that's easier to happen. I've just spoken recently in Rochester, New York with 60 or so staff from a university medical centre about these various reasons and outcomes, and they're trying to get them to start these conversations cross-professionally and at all levels of the organisation.
And are they open to it? Are they willing to do that process?
Well, time will tell. And I wasn't there for very long, but they politely listened to me and they didn't throw things at me, which may or may not be a good sign. There are a number of people now in dialogue, not just direct care staff, but administrators and the legal people, and ideally everybody in the organisation, from janitors, cleaners, receptionists, security, through to the psychiatrists, etc., and everybody in between should be part of that process.
Mm-hmm. Are there exemplars that have changed?
Not in North America as yet that I'm aware of, but I only have a very small sample, and I'm sure your listeners to this will be able to give me probably 9 bad cases and maybe 1 hopeful case. So if they can let me know through you, I'd be happy to continue the dialogue to help spread the good word.
At the risk of perpetuating the onus onto the individual worker, if someone is working in a toxic environment, and we know as child and youth care practitioners or youth workers in the Australian context, our career trajectory is not super, super long, right? Many of us do not last more than a decade, 15 years in this career because of these things. What can the individual CYC practitioner do in these situations?
Well, that's a very... very broad question, second only to what is the meaning of life. It's probably the same question in some ways. In my career, I've burnt out many times and have come back from it. Maybe that says a lot about me, I don't know. But and generally, we talk about, eat the right foods, exercise, don't smoke, etc. All these various relaxation exercises, which are all great and fine, and I encourage people to do that. But if the more deeper questions of who am I, what am I, why am I doing what I am, what I'm doing at the moment, what is my purpose, what is my direction, do I see myself here in 10 or 15 years, are all key questions to ask, because if this is not, and I believe in some ways it's a calling, it's not just a profession. And as I said, one of my concerns is professionalism is a twin-edged sword. And as I've seen here in some instances, the move towards professionalism can sometimes shut out the very reason for the professionalism, that is the voice of the young people and empowering them and supporting them. We need to be looking at these questions, be challenged, and the podcasts and things like you and others are doing are raising their head above the parapets long enough to think more broadly about these questions, rather than just how can I survive this shift or this week or whatever. So sometimes you need also to get a mentor outside of the organisation, and I do a lot of at times mentoring, sometimes for ex-students of mine going back 20 years, who still value my suggestions, and in turn I'm learning from them as well. So supporting each other, and I think especially outside of the work, because sometimes our relationships within work can be supportive, but that's all we know, those relationships with people, and with turnover and burnout or whatever, our team nature can change very quickly, and so we need an external support group, a mentor, as well as our own self-care. I wrote an article around the issue of caring for others and caring for ourselves, and I think that's a twin edge. Some people are very selfish, not caring for other people pour themselves out in caring, but meantime their family relationships, their health, they're becoming cynical and burnt out, so you need to do both. And knowing when to withdraw from the situation, just talking to a foster parent just in the last hour, helping him to talk through and decide whether he needs to take a sabbatical for a while, sometimes even a career change, the time to think through these issues, because he and his wife are very much involved in the face-to-face, but don't have time to stand back and say, well, you know, how do we get refreshment, renewal, get a buzz out of this, because often the agencies or the young people or the foster children don't always say thanks.
Indeed. Von Boy, I want to thank you as I move towards closing here. You know, it's an honor to speak with someone who's been working in this field since the 60s, who continues to work in this field, who has experienced burnout, who comes back, who learns to take care of themselves, who finds ways to mentor others and to share their wisdom from their journey. And the idea of workplace violence is one that often we don't think about. We think somehow we've chosen to be in this field. We work with, you know, gang members. We should expect to be exposed to violence. And if, you know, we're not prepared for that, we shouldn't be in this field. But I think you really remind us that there's significant structural issues as well as individual choices that we make to be in this field.
Just one mm-hmm. thing I'd like to add to that, in that rightly so, especially in North America, we're talking about a trauma-informed approach to care with young people. But as I indicated, I think research which you've made me aware of, and of others, is saying that you know, maybe 40-60% of child and youth care and other health professionals have suffered a number of major traumas in their life. So when we're looking at a trauma-informed care approach, we don't look just at that for the service users, the clients, the young people. We also need to look at it in terms of the workers, but also organisations themselves have trauma histories for various reasons. There may be, for instance, a death of a young person. I remember myself, a client in the service I was involved with, who was stabbed and strangled to death, and that impacts on myself personally, but on the organisation, eventually led to that organisation closing down. There are other less dramatic examples, but there are often these things which have happened which people are not talking about, haven't worked through, and haven't seen that the organisation itself has been traumatised, and they try to get on with business as usual, but well, they sweep it under the carpet and pretend, for often very good reasons, that it hasn't happened. But there are some skeletons which need to be dug up from shallow graves and buried properly, and to be to be grieved, and so the organisation can lance some of the pus of the toxicity of the pain that's there. And so at all levels we need to treat with a trauma-informed wisdom and care and compassion.
Well said. You know, it's quite reminiscent of the work that we do. We talk about you know, trauma histories of young people and abusive practices, and you're bringing awareness to organizational trauma and organizational abuse compounded with systemic pressures. You know, it gives us a lot to think about.
Could I give a commercial here?
Please do. Yes, please give your commercial.
Just if people are looking for further resources, I have some resources listed on my website which might be of interest, and I'd be interested to maybe get any feedback from people who found this this helpful. They can just go to VaughanBowie.com, and that will link you in with my stuff. And Vaughan is spelled V-A-U-G-H-A-N, Bowie as in Jim or David Bowie.com. And yeah, there may be some helpful resources there for you.
Beautiful. I will. I'll also put a link on the podcast page to your website, and your publication list is great. There's lots of stuff in there that I've quite enjoyed going through, as well as other stuff that you've given me. So thank you very, very much, Mr. Von Bowie. I hope the rest of your trip here in Canada and North America is enjoyable, and I hope that you continue to spread your knowledge and wisdom wherever you may end up.
Well, I'm learning a lot from you guys as well. Thank you very much. My pleasure.
You're welcome.